Hello, and thanks for joining us at Seen and Unseen Aloud. My name is Natalie Garrett. This is where you get to listen to a curated collection of the editor's top picks from our recent articles. We're here for you when you need to be eyes-free or hands-free, but still want to hear Christian perspectives on just about everything. Marriage is Martyrdom. Seriously? By Henna Kundill. It's late afternoon on a rainy Monday. My students mooch through the door, filling up the seats in our overheated, clinically modern tutorial room. They are a particularly young class this afternoon, nearly all still teenagers. The setting feels entirely wrong for poring over texts that are thousands of years old, texts written by some of the earliest Christians, now displayed on flashy laptops and smartphones. The first excerpt is short, part of a hand-scribbled note by Ignatius of Antioch. He wrote it even as he was marched to his execution at the hands of the Romans. "Suffer me, my brethren, hinder me not from living, do not wish me to die. Suffer me to receive the pure light. When I shall have arrived there, I shall be a human being." Ignatius shows no fear, despite facing his impending martyrdom, I explain, because he goes to his death as one who was utterly convinced by the hope of resurrection. To him, death was life and life was death. From the mixture of expressions on the faces around the room, I can easily tell which members of the class have attended Professor Baer's lectures on this week's material and which members of the class have attended only to their mattresses and duvets. 'Twas ever thus with undergraduates. Let's look at Professor Baer's own chapter on the subject, I suggest, adding with a certain emphasis, it was your required reading for this tutorial. Reading Ignatius, along with some other texts from this period, Baer summarises the argument as follows. Earthly life is a transitory thing, and driven by the fear of death, it becomes all too easy to focus on and hang on to this fleeting life. However, the Christian hope is that the self-sacrificing death of Christ, who gave up his life in the service of others, has transformed the reality of death. Death is no longer just the end of this life, but the beginning of another one, a better eternal life. And this, for each Christian, becomes the impetus to pursue one's own journey towards self-sacrifice, towards laying down one's earthly life for another, following in the example of Christ, just as Ignatius wished to do. Baer writes, "Through Christ's having changed the use of death, we are able to change the ground of our existence from necessity and mortality to freedom and self-sacrificial love." I glance around the room. A few students seem mildly interested. Some others are gazing at their screens, scrolling. Perhaps their curiosity has been piqued by the chapter they aren't meant to have read yet. More likely, they've zoned out and are flicking through TikTok. One guy at the back stares glumly out of the window, mouth half open. The one next to him is dismantling a ballpoint pen. A few moments later, however, and all their eyes are on me. Why? Because in the second part of his chapter, Baer takes this argument of self-sacrifice, of death to life, and uses it as a lens through which to examine the specific human phenomenon of marriage. I read out a few well-chosen excerpts, juicy ones that include the word eros, sexuality, and even ecstasy. And it's no surprise that a room full of drowsy teenagers becomes somewhat more alert. It is through the natural human desire to be united with another person, argues Baer, that we are truly drawn out of ourselves. And by doing so, we learn to give out of our own lives for the sake of the life of another. To commit one's life and one's body to another in marriage is the epitome of dying to self, even a kind of martyrdom. If marriage leads to parenthood, then the opportunity to live a life of self-sacrifice only increases. However hard it might be, those who are married, parenting, or both, are driven by love to place the lives of their spouses and their children before their own. Any thoughts? I ask the room. Every pair of eyes is on me, and I know that there are thoughts. The silence is thick with them. But who will be brave? Patiently, I stir them down. Eventually, someone cracks and a hand creeps up into the air. Yes, go ahead, I encourage. Well, I think you should never be in a relationship where you have to do that. Okay, we're off. Never have to do what, exactly? Like, be expected to give up your life for someone else. Like, it's your life. No one else has a right to ask you to sacrifice yourself. The conversation went on from there, the class getting more and more animated, a polemic against the idea that marriage, or just long-term relationships in general, should involve the sacrifice of oneself. A spouse, they insisted, should be someone who affirms and celebrates everything that you are, and who supports you in whatever dreams or ambitions that you want to chase. And children? Well, they should only be brought into the equation to fulfil your dreams, not to limit them. Marriage is many things, but it should not be a sacrifice, less still a martyrdom. Well, let's not be too hard on the optimism of youth. The optimism that imagines marriage and family life will be something that gives and gives and will never take anything away. How can they know? Those who have never been awake at 3 a.m. with a projectile vomiting toddler, and those who have never had to calmly negotiate over where all the money goes. It is the optimism of those who have never had to pass up on a job or an opportunity because it doesn't fit in with the spouse's promotion or the kid's schooling. These and a thousand other moments of self-sacrifice, the gritty realities of a daily choice to stick in a marriage or any kind of long-term relationship and make it work. But is this gritty reality a giving up of life or an embracing of it? Perhaps, like Ignatius, in this kind of death to self, we actually find life. In a committed union, we carefully place our lives in the service of another, not because they expect us to, but because out of love we choose to. This is done, of course, in trust that the other person will do the same in return. There is no suggestion either here or in Bear's chapter that someone should stay in a union where that placing of oneself is being merely used and abused, but where two people find a true mutuality in that laying down of self. Well, love has a funny way of making limits feel like a kind of freedom after all. Hinder me not from living, writes Ignatius as he marches to his certain death. His eyes were filled with the image of new self, a better self that would come to him all at once and suddenly through the laying down of his life for what he believed in. With a faith so strong, this may have been an easy kind of martyrdom, a decision made once, which could not by him be undone. But let us also hinder not those who choose to unite their lives to another. This is a much slower kind of martyrdom, a decision made not once, but daily, in a society where such decisions are frequently undone. One day, some of these young people will feel the call to this kind of death, and that in this death, there is life. Hinder them not to die. The Bullies Invoking Jesus as Their Best Buddy by George Pitcher. I'm not at all sure that the parents of a teenager driven to despair or even suicide by online trolls or a woman in a coercive relationship are likely to see their tormentors as victims, making a cry for help by making the lives of others intolerable. Bullies, it is said, have invariably been bullied themselves. Popular proverb has it that bullies never prosper, a comforting canard knocked down by some comprehensive research recently from the British cohort study that of 7,000 children born in 1970, it was the nastiest, most aggressive little pieces of work that did best in life by age 46. Social insecurity may well have driven their cruel treatment of others, but financial security has been their reward. Said one of the study's authors, "There's a strong link between aggressive behaviour at school and higher earnings later in life." What exemplars of that might we find on the international stage? Step forward the erstwhile and very possibly future President of the United States and the great returner President of Russia. Bullying may be too light a term for what Donald Trump has done to countless women and business associates in his life, what Vladimir Putin has done to Ukraine and other Soviet satellites, and what both men have done to their nation's electoral systems. But I want to make an armchair case for the psychological insecurity of both men. That insecurity presents itself in a rather pathetic, in a literal sense, desire to be loved, to be admired, and to be followed by devoted disciples. And what role model might they come up with for that? Why, of course, they have both invoked Jesus Christ as their best buddy, who is very much on their side politically and who is really a lot like them. Trump has endorsed excruciating, again literally, drawings of himself sitting in the dock at court with the Christ, and has published his own $60 Bible. One remembers the delightful self-publicist Jonathan King launching his fictional memoir entitled Bible 2. Putin has claimed that he's not a little like the Nazarene, calling fishermen by the Sea of Galilee as he rallies Russian youth to resist the pernicious culture of the satanic West. He casts himself, along with Jesus, as the defender of traditional values, though the conflation of the Christ with cultural tradition is a little awry, but never mind. There's pragmatic political ambition in both men for co-opting the Christ to their cause. Trump wants and needs the US Christian right on his side for re-election. Putin is promoting a rapprochement with Russian religions and already has the Russian Orthodox Church on side for his Ukrainian escapade. But there's something else going on here. The armchair psychologist can identify motives at work. Both Putin and Trump want not only attention, they've had all that, and they want a harder drug. Like most bullies, they want to be loved by those whose attention they have won. What better figure to associate themselves with than love incarnate? A demigod aspires to be loved as God loves and is loved. It may replace a familial love that has been missing, or it may simply be the toxic desire to be loved by those you oppress and by one's peers, again, the instinct of the bully. That's closer to admiration and has vanity at its root. Witness Putin's faintly ridiculous bared torso astride a horse as a younger man, or Trump's vainglorious comb-over and orange-tanned skin. Such a shame that we have no idea how the most famous figure who ever lived, whose legacy is the largest religion on earth, actually looked. Or they might try to look like that, because to their minds, emulation would win similar admiration. Finally, Trump and Putin need to be followed. Like bullies, they need their gang. Never mind that even the most devoted disciples of Christ abandon him to his fate in his mortal life. There's something like 2.5 billion declared followers of him today, some two millennia later. That's some legacy, and the kind that would shore up even for the deepest of their insecurities. Their problem, naturally, is that they can never quite make it, which can only compound their insecurity. The nature of Christian leadership at its source is unreachable. He said himself that we could not follow where he was going because it's a form of leadership beyond human scope. Self-sacrificial, infinitely humble, while also divine. That leadership was among us and we didn't recognise it. The leaderships of Trump and Putin, even as they claim Christ-like affinity, carve recognition and to be above us. These are not men who would lay down their power, far less their lives, for their friends. These are bullies in the playground of politics. We must pray for their souls as we condemn their actions. Killing Joy, VAR's Search for Objectivity is Flawed, by Graham Tomlin. I am a Manchester United fan, but I wish Coventry had won the FA Cup semi-final. I've supported United alongside my hometown team, Bristol City, ever since the days of George Best, Bobby Charlton and Dennis Law. Bristol City never win anything, so it's nice to have a team that does win things occasionally, or at least used to. In case you've had your head under a pillow since the weekend, or just avoid anything football-related on principle, Manchester United won an FA Cup semi-final replay on penalties by the skin of their teeth. 3-0 up and cruising after 70 minutes, they somehow capitulated to allow Coventry, a team in the division below, to score three goals in the last 20 minutes. With virtually the last kick of extra time, Coventry scored a fourth. Cue scenes of sheer unbridled ecstasy and abandon among the Coventry supporters. What they experienced at that moment is what every sports fan longs for. Beating your intense rivals or mounting an astonishing comeback, snatching victory from the jaws of defeat. When it happens, there is nothing like it. It's what United fans experience when they beat Liverpool with a last-minute winner in the quarter-final, or in the never-to-be-forgotten 1999 Champions League final when they scored twice in injury time to beat Bayern Munich. Now it was Coventry's turn. But then, the VAR, video assistant referee, like a killjoy schoolteacher, telling the kids they should calm down and not get so excited, spoiled the party. By pointing out that in the build-up, a Coventry player's foot was about 3 inches in front of the nearest body part of the last Man United defender, and so was offside. The offside rule exists to stop attackers gaining an advantage. Quite how those 3 inches gave the Coventry player an advantage is beyond me. Before VAR, the rule was that if the attacker was basically level with the defender, it was deemed to be onside. Let's face it, it was a perfectly good goal. Coventry should have won. They deserved to. This would have been one of the greatest comebacks in FA Cup history. For a second-tier team to come back from 3-0 down with 20 minutes left against a team of that fame and pedigree to potentially win the game was extraordinary. The sheer joy and ecstasy on the faces of the Coventry fans, incredulous that their team could perform such a feat against the great Manchester United, made every fan of every other club just wish something like that would happen to them. VAR was introduced to eliminate human error and to bring a more scientific and measurable accuracy to decisions like this. The reality is that it's done nothing of the kind, and in fact has made things worse. It is part of a general fallacy in our culture that science and objectivity give us all the answers we need. So we try to reduce the role of human instinct on the assumption that only what can be measured and exactly delineated is of any value. Hence Boris Johnson's mantra, follow the science, during the COVID pandemic. The reality is that following the science still leaves a place for human decision. Science doesn't necessarily tell you what to do. During the pandemic, it could tell us about the rate of spread of the virus, but it didn't dictate that a lockdown of the severity which we endured was necessarily the right way to deal with it. There was a human choice to be made, balancing the effect on the economy and the potential loss of life with the mental impact upon young people that is now becoming really apparent. In football, VAR doesn't solve every issue. It can tell whether the ball hit a defender's hand in the penalty area, but it still requires a subjective judgment by the referee or a VAR official. Over the weekend of semi-finals, it was decided to not award a penalty against Manchester City's Jack Grealish, but to do the opposite for Manchester United's Aaron Wan-Bissaka for virtually identical actions. VAR has not taken refereeing decisions out of the equation, hasn't made it any better. Yet the worst thing of all this is that it denied Coventry fans their moment of ecstasy, a moment they would bask in for the rest of their lives. The kind of moment for which football fans live, the experience that makes the years of watching 1-0 defeats away from home, trudging around the country following your team, worthwhile. A moment that, even as a Man United fan, I would not want to deny them. Of course I'll support United in the final against the robotically efficient Manchester City, but in that moment, VAR destroyed joy. And if that joy is caused by a marginal human error, who cares? Better to have the possibility of joy than a world where it gets taken away by a spoilsport official in a darkened room, watching screens and drawing fine lines across the pitch. Blaise Pascal once famously wrote that the heart has its reasons of which reason knows nothing. His point was that we have a deep instinct for things which we just know are right, that we cannot prove and just have to assume, and the attempt to reduce everything to rationality, to scientific explanation, to what can be measured, thinking that we can rely on the seen and not the unseen, is fundamentally flawed. Ever since the Enlightenment of the 18th century, we have lived with this dream of a perfectly scientific world where everything can be reduced to numbers, mechanisms, and measurements. In such a world, there is no room for God, no room for miracles. It even conspired to rule out the joy of Coventry fans celebrating a wildly unlikely winner. It tries to delude us that it takes subjective human or moral judgment out of the equation, but it can never do that. And in doing that, it sucks the joy out of life. Science is a great gift and it can tell us a lot about our world. But it cannot tell us everything. It was never meant to bear such weight. And the sooner we realise that it has its limits and doesn't overstep its boundaries, the better. Thank you for listening. If you like our podcast, help others to discover it. Leave a review and rate us wherever you get Seen and Unseen Aloud. Help others discover a world that is greater, more full of meaning and sense than they might ever have imagined.